Hello and welcome to another episode of Union Blue Radio. I'm your host, Sam Blazer, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Matt Suva. Unfortunately, no Allison Lucan today, so for all the Lucanites out there, you can turn this podcast off now. She's not going to be here.
Lucanites? Is that...
That's her fan club. I decided to name them as such.
Yes, we Lucan. Is that their motto?
I would guess so. I would definitely guess so.
Yeah,
we'll be joined by Garrett Hole, though, a little later on to talk about the Winnipeg Jets.
Joining the three-timer club.
Exactly, joining the three-timer club of guests. And we're going to talk a little bit about hockey analytics as well. He's the chief technical officer at Hockey Data Inc. So
very excited.
Yeah, exactly. First off, though, the World Cup of Hockey has ended.
It's over.
Yeah. Graduation, was it? As we go on, we remember.
I think if you sing too much of that, then we get copyright notices.
Yeah, exactly. This won't be able to be put up on iTunes. Canada, of course, beat Europe in the final series 2-0. Canada won 3-1 and then 2-1 in the second game. Sidney Crosby, MVP. What were the lessons from the tournament? Any conclusions to draw? Maybe hockey is a boring, predictable sport?
I feel as if the same lessons that you can learn from March Madness also apply in this case, that one and done, with the exception of the final, but in general, one and done are very limited showing tournament things. How much do you really learn? So I know we have harped on, and everybody else in the hockey world has harped on, Team USA as being an example of their current formulation of their team was a failure or whatever. Are they truly a failure for having run into Carey Price and Yaroslav Halak in two of the three round robin games they had to play? What are you supposed to do if you're facing the two best goalies in the tournament? You lose two games and you're completely done. There's no going on to the semifinal. I think that this is a difference. This is where you can find the difference between probabilistic things and evaluating based on small samples. Because, yes, it's fair to say an example of Team USA, including Tyler Johnson, Phil Kessel, Nick Leddy, whatever, would have improved their chances. But I don't know that there's anything they could have done when you're facing the hot goalies that you did. So I don't know that there are real big lessons to take away from this, except in the extremes. And the one real extreme is that Canada just knocked over everybody.
Yeah, the only way that could have been worse for the Team USA is if they faced Russia and Sergei Bobrovsky.
I know. Then that would be all the goalies. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, we've brought up this point before, and I know you've kind of harped on it. How bad is it when you actually don't win like the entire thing? There's only one team that can end up winning it. So, it obviously would have been better for optics' sake if they made it out of the group stage.
Oh, sure.
But I don't think overall it's something to be ashamed of.
No.
I think that they can definitely improve the roster selections. I think coaching-wise, it was an interesting selection just because John Tortorella was balancing two things. And he even said multiple times how he wished that he could have been at Blue Jackets camp, because I think he knows, and I think this is the case for multiple other coaches, including like Mike Babcock, is that they would much rather end up being at one of these, one or the other. They wouldn't want to be, you know, exclusively just Team Canada, or, you know, they just want to exclusively be with the Toronto Maple Leafs, because they need to focus on those people. And if you're someone like Mike Babcock, you may be superhuman and coach both teams and do well with both of them, but that's, you know, more of an outlier than anything. And I think overall, and in the future, that they're going to set this up almost more world championship like, not necessarily in player wise, but how the coach has no other responsibilities at the time, and then put him in control, and it won't be so, you know, far away, because like it was so weird how they named their coaches a year in advance, and then they like did the players like way far in advance. There needs to be, I think, a little bit more intrigue, at least in my opinion.
I guess at the same time, from an NHL marketing perspective, what better way to drum up random interest in the middle of when did they announce the rosters? Like April?
Yeah, something like that.
So just random. Here's a list, and that caused, I think, our own podcast had commentary on it that it was just, oh, let's talk about this because we can. I don't know. If it's a best on best thing, then I guess that draws interest regardless. At the same time, I will say, even though I don't think it's fair to draw real conclusions about the state of hockey for any country or team or whatever off of a tournament with such quick turnaround, such short showings, it's still very fun. I still enjoyed it on the whole. I don't know that you can make real serious judgments about USA Hockey or Team Sweden or anybody except Team Canada. At the same time, it was still very fun to watch. I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, that in regard to the you know, the enjoyment there. What did you think about the like ESPN's broadcast coverage? I liked it, and I know that there's some people who are upset that ESPN was covering hockey, blah blah blah, and you know they shortchanged them back in like 2004. I don't really care about that, if I'm being honest. What I'm more interested in is what they could possibly do in the future, and maybe some split broadcast rights, how they could possibly bring in more money for the league, and you know, possibly better athletes, things like that. That would all, I think, be really compelling to me. And I think John Buchagross and Steve Levy did a fine job.
I agree.
And I think some people give them too hard of a time.
I think that's fair. I think there are some fair criticisms about Barry Melrose and some of his just speaking entirely in cliches for minutes on end. Mm-hmm. There's that. On the whole, though, ESPN has great broadcast quality and great presentation of all of their products, and this was no exception. And purely from a hockey exposure point of view, I understand that there's this scorn about ESPN leaving during lockout year, which how much of that do you put on ESPN? How much of that do you put on ownership? Even though there is that scorn, boy, it's real easy to find ESPN everywhere you are, as opposed to...
Oh, without doubt. I went into every single... Like, when I went... I made it sound like I went into, like, a million
you
bars.
You went into every bar in Columbus.
Yeah, exactly. But almost everywhere I went, though, when I did go out, that was on.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
ESPN...
For the sport. The optics and the visuals for the league is good when you're able to do something like that.
And then all of those games, at least one or two per night, ended up on SportsCenter in the top 10, which I know that's a cliched thing, but that's the highlight package that you always watch when you're watching SportsCenter. It's the thing that draws you. It's the thing that you remember. It is the pre-internet version of lists that everybody likes to click on, even though they say they don't like them. They love them, and they click them, and they watch the top 10. So
10 reasons to watch the World Cup of Hockey, and you won't believe what number 9 is.
I'm intrigued now.
But in all seriousness, what ESPN does is bring in younger viewers as well.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what channel ESPN is in their home. If you're a young child who's into like athletics of any sort, they're just a huge fan. And if you're able to get those young fans interested in the sport, and you know, not trying to search around for NBC Sports, then that's obviously a plus.
Yep.
And I think anytime you can get into that many homes is fantastic, even though I think the numbers were pretty abysmal. They weren't great from what I understand.
I guess it's a chance type of thing, that you have a better chance of accessing more people and hopefully generating enough buzz to get people interested again, that kind of thing.
Exactly, giving people at least the option. But World Cup of Hockey, we won't have to deal with that for, what, another 4 years now? So,
I guess we eventually...
Or at least until the Olympics.
Yeah, eventually we'll get to contend with whether or not Olympics are happening or not for the NHL. That seems to be questionable at best at this point.
True, very true. But in the meantime, while the World Cup of Hockey is happening, Blue Jackets training camp started.
We are right in the throes of it.
Exactly, and now we are right in the throes of it. Allison had a great article coming up for the Blue Jackets about the Blue Jackets' young D-men. I wrote a thing about my three thoughts from training camp thus far. Plenty of roster cuts, most notably Dean Kukin, Nick Motry, Dante Salutaro, and Ryan Craig. They all got sent down to Cleveland. And then there's a couple injuries as well with Dylan Hetherington and Keegan Kolesar, two players that you know are needed at least in camp or in their respective teams for development purposes, since they are so stinking young.
I think they're both listed as 6-ish week.
Yeah, fractured wrist
outlook,
and
yeah.
Supra umbilical hernia.
I don't want to know what that is.
I actually looked it up, and it's very, very gross.
That, please no.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want to know more, you can look it up. Ooh. I'm not going to be the person that divulges it to you. So what are your thoughts of training camp thus far? Any big takeaways? I've been able to watch a few games, been able to listen to a few games, catch some box scores. What do you think? What are you thinking? What are your thoughts?
I don't have a lot of thoughts at this point. We were kind of discussing this in our Slack chat a little today. How many conclusions can you really draw from preseason games that are half an NHL team at most against another half an NHL team? I think you can isolate a few players and cases and say, oh, look, they're performing above and beyond. However, performing above and beyond against a non-NHL lineup, it, in my estimation, seems like at best you're saying, well, at least they weren't underperforming. It's hard to draw real conclusions from that. I'll take the St. Louis games, for instance, the ones that we had talked about these a little last week.
Mm-hmm.
The one in St. Louis featured a fair number of first and second liners for the Blues against a defense that was not an NHL defense for the Jackets. So what? How do you feel about 7 goals against a non-NHL defense? I don't think you feel anything about that. I suppose as we go further along and the rosters become realer, it'll be a little more telling who's left, who's being looked at, who's performing in those games. But even so, we Allison pointed this out today on the Slack chat. You may recall an NHL team last year that won the preseason and then proceeded to go 0-8 to start the season, the regular season,
yeah,
dropping all the way to 30th place. We may know who that was.
The Columbus Blue Jackets. I think the only thing you can really take away from training camp is if someone is extremely, extremely dominant and if someone's extremely, extremely poor. If you see someone, say, like, for instance, Marcus Nudivaara right now, he's someone who's...
He's someone you've talked about.
Yeah, exactly. He's someone right now who's putting up numbers that are comparable to Seth Jones. And, like, if you're able to do something like that, considering, you know, you were playing in the Finnish Elite League last year, and, you know, you're able to transfer that game over, and you haven't looked like you're out of place, that's someone that I think you want to give a chance to. But by the same token, if you see someone like Brett Gallant come here and, you know, put up a 25% Corsi 4 percentage at even strength, then you know that, you know, he is what he is.
Yeah.
He's a fighter, and he's not going to do anything there. You're obviously going to face, you know, a line or two of good players, maybe a pair, you know, of good players, and then some guys who are mixed in there. But nonetheless, there are still some players there that you can face up against that are impressive. So that's why I think it's interesting when you see Zach Werenski, Marcus Nudivaara, Sonny Milano do well in you know, their limited time, because even if they're paired, like, you know, with Brandon Saad or with like Daniel Zaar or someone like that, it, you know, those are still players that they could potentially be playing with, and if you're able to perform even against, like, you know, minimal competition, then I think that's a good thing.
Certainly better than the alternative.
Yeah, without a doubt. You don't want to, you know, look at the numbers and look at the stats and see, oh, Brandon Saad actually was posting like a 30% Corsi 4 percentage, which he isn't. He's posting like well above 50%.
Yeah, that would be scary.
So I think there's some good to it and there's some bad to it. But as of right now, if you're John Tortorella trying to get players into shape, I think you pretty much know what you're going to get. From, and I also think that most of their rosters are set. I think that as of right now, we're recording on Tuesday, a little bit before the Nashville Predators game. I think that the forwards, obviously a lot of one-way contracts, the defensemen, a lot of one-way contracts, goalies, a lot of one-way contracts. I think they pretty much know what they're going to have. The Jonas Korpisalo, Anton Forsberg, they want to see what they're going to get from them. Forwards like Oliver Bjorkstrand, Josh Anderson, Sonny Milano, those are the forwards that they want to see. But, you know, those are like one or two spots. You know, Daniel Zaar, Lucas Sedlak, those aren't going to be the people that are competing unless they, you know, put up absolutely ridiculous numbers in one of these last few games and force their way into camp. Do you What do you foresee in that front? Do you still think that Oliver Bjorkstrand and Josh Anderson are going to be making this team? Or if you had to, you know, throw your hat into the ring, what are your guesses?
I don't know. Aaron Portsline, the past day or two, has been tweeting quite a bit about how the team really expects more out of a Bjorkstrand in particular if he's really making this solid push to show up on the NHL roster long term. I guess that leaves me curious as to what's left for him to prove. I understand that the currency is you have to earn your way in kind of deal. At the same time, he was so good in the NHL last year, and he performed so well in the AHL playoffs. Is there concern if he's not playing as well now? Is there concern? I don't know. What benefit of a doubt do you give a guy who had past performances that were really good? I don't know. And that's why I'm not on the coaching staff.
There's something to be said about resting on your laurels. And I know that they wanted youngsters to kick some of the older players out to see if they would do that. That was something that they said all over the place. Anywhere you looked, that seemed to be like their battle cry. And that hasn't happened. And I think that there are some I think that, you know, Brandy Dubinsky, Cam Atkinson, those players, they were going to be fine no matter what. But, you know, they're actually still putting up stuff in the preseason when they don't need to.
Yeah. I think the next few games, there are what? After tonight's game, there are two more preseason games left. I think it'll be interesting to see who remains after tonight, whatever additional cuts are made, and then who gets leaned on in the last few preseason games to see what the thought process is right now, who's expected to be pushing and who's actually making those pushes. I will note, I have kind of devalued the information from the preseason, but if you are interested, a favorite site of our blog, Natural Stat Trick, is yet again a great resource. They have preseason information about all the players and their performances so far. So if you want to go check that out, they've got all of the shot differential information you could ever want.
Is there a player in training camp that's disappointed you at all? Obviously not personally, but like from an expectation.
Personally.
Yeah, from an expectation standpoint, is there a player that overall isn't really up to what you thought he was going to be?
None immediately. I was excited to see what would become of Abramov, but he was one of the first or second set to go back to juniors. I guess that's to be expected given his age and his size and all of that. So it's kind of disappointing that he didn't get to stick around longer. We didn't get to see more of his innate skill. But what can you do? He's not a first round draft pick, and so there is that roughness. However rough that is, that the team is likely interested in getting sorted out in junior first.
Another player that I think I've been kind of disappointed by, and it's not, you know, overly disappointing, is Pierre-Luc Dubois. Especially considering the expectations that he came in with and, you know, the hubbub that was surrounding him. There was even talk about, you know, possibly winning the Calder Trophy for, you know, Rookie of the Year. I think for him, he just needs to, you know, take his time with his development. I don't think he's going to be someone that bursts into this lineup and is a center. I don't think he's going to kick, you know, Gregory Campbell out of the lineup and be that presence. I think as of right now, you know, he's a fine player, you know, not necessarily fine-tuned enough to play in the NHL. Do you think he's going to get the 9 games, though?
That's what I was going to ask you. How dare you?
My answer is no.
I'm going to say
I know
yes.
I know you want to give like a nuanced answer. I'm
going to
no.
say yes, just to disagree with you. I feel as if, particularly given the information that will come with the last 3 preseason games tonight and the next 2, hopefully that will give more of a clue if he's looking more attuned to the speed, to the style of the NHL game. I'm going to say yes, that he'll get at least a few of the 9, and we'll see from there.
Yeah, it's really hard to say, you know, because of we don't have direct access to the club.
No.
But it's interesting and compelling to watch how they try to select these players, because there are some players that they've inherited, there are some players that they traded for, and how they handle them, you know, gives us some future, you know, insight to what how they think. If they keep Pierre-Luc Dubois around, they haven't been someone that, like, you know, immediately puts someone into the lineup like that. But I think they really, really do believe in this player, and I think that they also, by the same token, want him to, you know, be an impactful player.
And they want
to show that, I think, the fans and the team, that he's someone that they're gonna, you know, they believe seriously could make an impact in the future.
He's a long-term investment, and
wholeheartedly.
Whether or not that investment starts paying dividends this year or if that's next year, it's not a huge difference. It's not a huge deal, because if there is concern that he's not ready immediately, then there's no need to screw up development. There's no need to waste a year of contract.
And I don't think a 9-game, you know, tour in the NHL would really, like, ruin anything.
No, absolutely not.
But I do think that, you know, he'll probably end up getting sent back, and I don't think he's going to get the 9 games. And I think afterwards he'll probably end up heading to the AHL, and I wouldn't even mind seeing him a year in the AHL, too.
Mm, really projecting out for him.
No, I really am, because, like, from what I've watched him, he's good on the puck, he's good defensively, but he's not had that, you know, take over a game type mentality just yet that you see with, like, these high end first round picks.
Yeah.
Especially the number three overall pick.
Yep. Yeah.
That's just me. I don't know. I'm just a pie in the sky guy. That's just me, Matt.
Well, why do you have pie in the sky?
You know, it should be in my mouth.
It should. These are important lessons, yeah. Everybody.
That's Union Blue Radio for you. But I guess after all of that discussion about pie, it's time to have Garrett Hole onto the podcast. We'll be right back. And we are back, and now joined by Garrett Hole, Chief Technical Officer of Hockey Data. Garrett, how are you doing today, buddy?
I'm pretty good. And yourself?
Can't complain. Matt's got the first question for you.
Yeah, so thanks for joining us. World Cup of Hockey is over, but we did want to pick your brain on something that you shared on Hockey Graphs a day ago. You broke down a few selected micro stats for each team in the tournament, and we'll point listeners to that article in our show notes. You shared that Canada was not the best team in the tournament in terms of breaking out of the defensive zone or entering the offensive zone. And I'm kind of curious, did you expect Canada to be so normal in those respects?
It was a bit surprising. I mean, the one thing that I didn't, I think, stress enough is there's a lot more to it than what I just looked at. It was quite a bit surprising just because the fact that, I mean, Canada did move the puck well, and they also were one of the most dominant teams in terms of outshooting their opponents. It wasn't like the team was just all on shooting percentage and save percentage. The team was consistently controlling the puck. And so one of the ways that we look at is how do players help their team in outshooting is usually by looking at how efficient they are in terms of breaking out of the defensive zone and also gaining control with the puck in the defensive zone, the opposition's defensive zone. So it was a little bit surprising, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, following up on that, a clear Canadian team strength you shared was Canada's ability to limit the opposition's transition. Does that kind of system imply a more oppressive move of play? Do you think that's the most effective system in general for NHL teams to win with? Does it indicate more about, like, what's going on with Mike Babcock as a coach?
I think a lot of it has to do with Mike Babcock. I mean, he does play a very suppressive game, very low, a low event game. That's kind of been his style for a little while now. And whether or not it's the best system, in my personal opinion, and well, the numbers do back up some of this, is the fact that the best system is not necessarily the best for everyone. A lot of it has to depend with what's your horses. For example, just like looking at a pure probability standpoint, the better of a team you are, the more beneficial it is for you to play a high event hockey, because the more goals that are scored, the more likely the better team's going to win. And then the worse, on the other hand, the worse that you are in talent in terms of outscoring your opposition, the lower scoring game you want to play, because the weaker you are, the more you want it to be left to chance about who's going to win. So that's why you want a low scoring game. Now, in terms of Canada, Canada was an elite team. Would they need a suppressive system like that? I don't really think they would. And I think that another thing that was kind of missed that I should have mentioned is there's other impacts that we're missing out. Like, for example, Canada was pretty heavy on the stretch pass. And I looked at defensive zone exits and also offensive zone entries as separate entities. But I didn't look at things like, for example, which defensive zones exits end up actually successfully being zone entries and those type of factors. Which, like, for example, we've noticed stretch passes tend to negatively influence your zone exit percentage, but it will actually improve the success's chance of being. So in more layman terms, basically what I mean is the stretch pass might make it tougher to break out, but what it will do is the times that you do break out, you have a higher chance of actually getting in the offensive zone and putting a shot on the net. So that's part of it. But Team Canada was very suppressive. They were able to prevent the team to transition back towards their own zone. And another thing that Canada was able to do was cycle extremely well. So once the puck was in the offensive zone, it was almost never leaving.
So I do have another follow-up to that. Do you think that there is enough separation of talent in the NHL for there to be that obvious a difference between the really suppressive play versus the really high event play? Like, with the exception of maybe Buffalo in their very clear tanking year, it doesn't seem as if there's a huge, huge difference between the true best teams and then whatever next tier there is. Is there that big a difference in the coaching styles applied in the NHL then?
There's definitely a difference in talent with the coaching and their strategies. Whether there should be, that is definitely a harder or tougher question, and I'm definitely being more theoretical at this point.
Yeah.
And just guessing. There's a huge amount of I've just forgotten the term. The term that Bettman loves. There we go, parity. There's a huge amount of parity in hockey, and part of it is real and part of it is artificially created because of the fact that there's the Bettman overtime loss point or shootout loss point. In terms of whether I think that I think even with the goal scoring rates that we have at with teams and their differences in skill levels, well, parity is a huge thing in hockey, and it's one of the major sports with the highest amount when you compare it towards MLB or NBA, or even when you look at different like hockey leagues, when you're looking at the KHL over in Europe or with junior leagues, there's definitely a huge amount of parity in the NHL, but I think there's still enough that when you're at a different team, any little advantage that you can get, whether it's just a little bit, is still worth gunning for.
Without a doubt. Now, one more follow-up on the World Cup article. The numbers that you've used are coming from Hockey Data, a new company you started to provide statistical analysis to clients. And I know this is kind of a recent development, right? And how exactly did it get started? How is everything going so far? And what's next for Hockey Data?
It's difficult to talk Hockey Data without talking a little bit of my own background. But I, like a lot of people who you probably interview on the show who are into like analytics, stats, and that kind of stuff. I started off in the blogosphere. I was a science student myself, doing biostatistics and analytical chemistry, and I got interested on a website that we were actually talking before the show, Behind the Net. back when Behind the Net was a blog and also a website to gather statistics, and the work there of Gabriel Desjardins kind of introduced me into hockey statistics, and I thought it was pretty neat. Started asking some questions, eventually got into blogging myself. I started my own blog, Hockey Graphs, which I believe is the number one independent blog on hockey statistics. There's some non-independent blogs that do quite well. And yeah, and from that, I kind of got exposure. And about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I started doing a little bit of consulting, whether for media members who are much larger than I, like at TSN or Sportsnet. But I also started doing some consulting for a player agency as well as a college level hockey team. And from that experience, I basically was able to slowly and surely start this company, Hockey Graphs. We've only existed, or sorry, Hockey Data. That's the problem about running two different companies that both start with hockey. but yeah, Hockey Data, we only incorporated not too long ago, but we've been kind of behind the scenes for a little while now. So this is our second season working with teams. And right now we're starting a new project where we're tracking the entirety of the AHL, basically creating our own like Corsica or our own extra skater, whatever, yeah. On AHL statistics that we're selling to teams. And we're also giving little tidbits, little bites here and there to media members.
Very exciting. We look forward to hearing more about how it goes as it develops. So now, shifting gears, we want to also pick your brain on some Winnipeg questions. The Jets didn't appear to be very flashy in the offseason. No big coaching shakeups, no big management turnover. Is there a best move that the Jets made over the summer? Is there reason to expect improvement over last year?
Well, I think there's reason to expect improvement over last year just by the point that I don't think the Jets were as bad as they were last year.
That's fair. I mean,
one thing that I kind of thought was funny, and I've never researched this before, but both the first overall and second overall pick went to teams that had above 50% score adjusted Corsi last year. And I don't think that's ever happened before. So I expect a little bit of bounce back. How much of bounce back kind of depends on what they do. The way that I look at it is I was okay with the Jets not making any big splashes because the fact that, in my personal opinion, the Jets have the horses. It's just whether they choose the right horses. Like when you go with the fours, they have a huge amount of depth, especially with the additions of Patrick Laine from the 2016 draft, and as well as Kyle Connor from the 2015 draft, are both going pro and probably making the team. And you have the fact that they have a lot of prospects who've been on the cusp for a while now who are trying to make pushes, whether it's Joel Armia or Nick Petan or Marco Dano and Andrew Kopp. And so, I mean, this youth, because of the fact that these players are quite a bit younger and they're looking to make significant impacts on the front end. I don't really see much of a need for a big splash. Towards defensemen, I always thought that the team needed a left-handed shot defenseman to prove there, and that was the one area I was kind of disappointed that they didn't really go for. And it looks like even more so now that we have the big Jacob Trouba issue going on. But then in net, like, I believe that the Jets have the horses in Connor Hellebuyck and Michael Hutchinson, but it's whether or not they're going to play the $5 million contract of Andre Pavlik or if they're going to send it down to the AHL.
Yeah, and, you know, Matt is a big fan of college hockey, and we both actually got opportunities to watch Kyle Connor play when they're playing Ohio State because, you know, we were following Zach Werenski. You know, Kyle Connor seemingly always scored at will. How is he fit into the equation during Winnipeg's training camp, and do you expect him to be with the NHL team this season?
At first, I would have, if you asked me about 2 weeks ago, I probably would have said 50-50. Now I think he's probably on the team. He's had an excellent preseason thus far. He's scored a goal in all three of the games that he's been in. And he's been looking very good. I mean, he's still needs a lot of work in the defensive zone, as you expect from someone who just came out of college hockey, but his speed is exceptional and his ability to put the puck on the net and put the puck into the net is very, very coveted. And I mean, the only thing that I thought was pushing him back before was maybe the fact that the Jets drafted Patrick Laine this summer. But and this, I mean, it's tough to make the Jets on the wing just because that's one of the it's a little bit easier on the center because they don't really have much there. But it looks like the Jets are probably going to run all of Ehlers, Wheeler, Laine, Stafford, and Connor as five of their top six wingers. Who that sixth guy is kind of an unknown, but it looks like, yeah, Connor's going to slide in on the third line and take a sheltered scoring role with Matthew Perreault.
So you have already hinted at some of the issue involved, but do you have a personal expectation as to who starts in goal for the Jets? And do you think it's Pavlik? Do you think he holds on to that job? Do the Jets decide to actually go with one of their other probably more talented goalies at some point? Or do you not have a real feel for it yet?
Yeah, I always say anyone's guess is as good as mine. Basically, you have three netminders. You have Andre Pavlik, who's slated to get paid $5 million approximately this year. I'd have to double check to see it exactly, but I think it's around that. Who's at the end of his contract that was like getting paid higher and higher salary each year. He's on his last year. Then you have Michael Hutchinson, who they probably don't want to lose to waivers because they signed him a contract specifically because Andre Pavlik is a UFA next year. Hutchinson's contract has one more season because of the fact that they wanted him, Hutchinson, to be compliant for the expansion draft.
Yeah.
And then you have Connor Hellebuyck, who is, in my personal opinion, he's already the best. And to almost everyone's opinion, he's going to be the answer in the Jets in the future. So, I mean, do they go for the best guy who's also just so happens to be the only guy that can go through waivers? Or are they going to risk losing Hutchinson to waivers and then no longer have expansion-compliant goaltender to be able to put out there? Or are they going to send down Andre Pavlik, who's, in my opinion, the worst of the three, but he's also the highest paid of the three?
Tricky, tricky balance. So a Columbus-centric question. How's Marco Dano doing? We remember him for his sudden burst on the scene and off-the-charts good shot metric performance alongside Scott Hartnell. From an outside view, it doesn't look like that carried over, at least in terms of chance to play with Chicago and now sort of with Winnipeg. Do you think he's going to get a shot at a regular role at some point?
I think he will at some point. He's still in camp, and I think right now the Jets are at I'm not certain. I believe they're around 22 forwards right now in camp after they did cuts this morning, and three of those guys are injured. So I mean, he's definitely on the cusp. He did well, I thought, especially when he was on the wing of Matthew Perreault and Alexander Burmistrov last year. And I've always been a big fan of him. But yeah, I've noticed that especially scoring rates haven't been quite the same. They definitely suffered when he was in Chicago. But he did well in terms of shot metrics with Winnipeg during his short stint last year. In terms of this year, though, I think the fact that Marco Dano is one of the few guys that doesn't require waivers, he might be looking on the outside, especially because of the fact that the Jets also have, as I noted before, they have Nikolai Ehlers, they have Blake Wheeler on the top line for wing, then they have Patrick Laine and Drew Stafford on the second line wing, and then the third line wing, it looks like Kyle Connor is making the team. So then you have three wing spots in the end. So that's being fought over by Nick Batan, Marco Dano, Joel Armia, Alexander Burmistrov, pugilistic veteran, all heart, Chris Thorburn, and a couple other guys of that type. So, I mean, it's definitely going to be hard for him. The numbers and the odds are against him, but he's been doing well, and I think at the very least he's going to be a big player in the HL for the organization, and probably get his call-ups, and I think next year is going to be his big chance to be an NHL regular.
Well, good competition from a Jets perspective anyway, I suppose.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally. Now, here's the million-dollar question, and this is the last question from us before, you know, we get to some plugs with you. What's going to happen to Jacob Trouba? Do you think he's actually going to get traded, or is he just going to be, you know, a little bit of a holdout, and then they'll end up coming to terms?
I've changed my mind on this a couple of times, and it's a weird and tough situation. And I really wish it didn't exist, because Jacob Trouba, even prior to him being drafted by the Winnipeg Jets, I've always been a big fan of this game. I've always enjoyed him when he was on the U.S. National Development Team, and then also, of course, when he was playing in Michigan. Whenever it comes to big players who are mean and also score, they're always fun to play, or fun to watch, and fun to have play on your team. And when you're looking at what's going to happen, again, just kind of like the Jets goaltender slot, I think it's anyone's guess. I'm leaning towards the fact that trade's going to happen, whether or not that's the case. I mean, a lot of it has to do with who's kind of going to flinch first, because the Jets right now, they have a very, very, very limited limited shopping list of what they want. They're not looking for adding on the wingers. They're not looking for future pieces like first round draft picks. They're not. What they want is they want a player who's similar to Jacob Trouba, who can come in and play in the NHL right now, and who's a left-handed shot defenseman. So basically, the only type of people who are going to want to trade that are people who are in a similar situation as the Jets, where they have a pretty good left-handed guy, but they want a right-handed guy. And so that's a very small shopping list. And so because of that, the Jets are willing to just, you know, let Jacob Trouba sit out until he either signs or they get what they want in return for him. And so whether the Jets either cave in first and trade him for something that's a little bit lesser, or Trouba caves in and ends up signing a bridge deal, hoping to get traded in the future, I don't know which one will happen first.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to say. Now, Garrett, we want to give you an opportunity to plug whatever you'd like. Whether your Twitter page, a TV show, or movie you've been watching, it's up to you.
So you can follow me on Twitter on Gareth OHL. a long running joke.
The truth comes out.
Yeah. The things that I did not expect to happen when I put my name in all like lowercase letters. But yeah, so GAREThOHL, and you can find me on there. And I still blog occasionally on Jets Nations and Hockey Graphs. And then I'm also blogging occasionally from the Hockey Data website. And you can see me complain online too much about Mark Stewart and Chris Thorburn.
No movie or TV show, huh? I'm disappointed.
Well, I just rewatched Breaking Bad, but it's already ended. So
yeah.
And it's a show that ended a long time ago. Yeah. So
plug it again, though, man. It's a great show.
It is a great show. It was great the second time through. You know what? It was a show that, like, sometimes you watch the second time through on a TV show, and you're like, oh, these are the parts I like. So you like watch it, but the parts you don't like, you just like skip. I didn't end up doing any of that. I didn't end up fast forwarding or skipping any parts, and it was just as good the second time through.
That's just how darn good that show is. But Garrett, we really appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're back after a conversation with Gareth OHL. He's always a great guest. Part of the three-timer club, you know, a great list including Rob Mixer and Derek, the coach.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of both. But I guess it's time for some plugs, right?
It can be.
It's time for some plugs.
We'll make it.
You're gonna kick it off for us.
Okay. I would like to plug the New York Baseball Mets, who somehow have decided that they should be in the postseason for a second year in a row. It's unprecedented. They're just a completely broken roster with none of their good pitchers left except Noah Syndergaard. So who knows? I'm just enjoying the ride. Go Mets.
And I'm going to plug. I'm going to plug the Cleveland Indians. I haven't been following them that much this year, but it's been more so than in years past because they've been so bad, and I used to be such a big fan in the early 2000s. Indians will be facing off with, I don't even know who they're facing shortly. But either way, I'm excited to watch them play, and I'm excited to see who they're going to put out in the field. So roll Tribe.
Roll Tribe? I didn't know that was a thing.
Oh, yeah. It's a thing. It's a thing, all right.
Wow.
You can follow me at Sam_Blazer. You can follow Matt at Zeke Bud. You can follow Allison at Allison L. You can follow the website at Buckeye ST Hockey.
You can listen to Barney squeaking his squeaky toy.
You can listen to my dog squeak his squeaky toy all over the house. I'm glad he held off until the very end.
It was so close.
But I think it's pretty much it, right?
Check out the website. We've got the top 25 under 25 list is almost over. We're into the real, real good players.
Exactly.
Now we've got other dogs barking.
Other dogs barking. And with that being said, until next week, bye.